We're CADA. That's me, Jared, and Sophia Oliveira there. We make software, and we're not going to repeat what we said about an introduction to this program, which we did last session with Adam Greenfield, but I will introduce Alice Benicia, and Sarah M. Watson. Sorry.
It's all right. It's Alice, actually.
Okay. They will both talk for about 35 minutes. Might go on a bit longer than that. And then after that, there'll be a Q&A. Yeah? So, Alice Benicia holds a PhD in science and technology and law and an MA in the philosophical foundations of physics and an MFA in photography and related media. She has been an appointed expert at the Joint Research Centre of the European Commission, and it's in that role that we kind of found Alice, because she published a report called Agency in the Internet of Things in 2013 with Angela Guimarães and Paula Covella. Was that Covella?
Covella.
Which provided a very broad reflection on the scientifically driven transformation of our reality that we're finding ourselves in now. It was focused on the Internet of Things, which she'll define in a minute. And for us, this report was... We used it heavily in our workshops. It was actually the clearest definition of the Internet of Things we could find. And what was good about it for us is the way that it dealt with the ethics of the Internet of Things. And when I say the reality that we're entering into, it also dealt with the kind of deep ontological shifts in our reality. So the position that we're feeling ourselves, or finding ourselves in. This report... if you can't find it online, I'm sure it is still online. It was published by the Joint Research Centre, so it should be fairly easy to find. I'm sure it's still online, but it's also appeared in a book called The End of the Cartesian Dream. More specifically, within this report, Alice introduced the idea that the objects that we are creating and using, relating to and sharing... correspond to specific imaginaries of innovation. And that, more importantly, that these imaginaries, this idea of innovation, remains unquestioned. And that our relationship with these objects is invisible. And by unquestioned, Alice means that they're either explicitly or subtly embedded in action. That is, in the mundane activities, but also in the arts, research, funding schemes, and the corporate rhetoric. So we're surrounded by this ideas of innovation, and half the time it's not being acknowledged. I think that's the way I put that in short. anything else you want to add there?
Oh, maybe I'll just, yeah.
No, go straight into it then. Okay. Sarah M. Watson... is a technology critic. We like the fact that she's a technology critic, you know, which is great. You know, there are critics and technology critics. And a research fellow at the Tao Center of Digital Journalism, Columbia University. She is also an affiliate with the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Her work explores how we are learning to live with, understand and interpret our personal data and the algorithms that shape our experiences. She investigates the way that corporations, governments, and individuals use data from wearable sensors, the Internet of Things, and other digitally processed systems. She engages and influences public discourse on technological change in popular culture. Again, this was very important for us in that you can read Sarah's work. It's very accessible. It uses popular culture as a subject and decodifies it. beautifully. There is nobody else like Sarah on that front. No, seriously, I mean, it really is like that. It's excellent. But what drew us to Sarah was, this might sound a bit strange, but it was a review of Jaron Lanier's Who Owns the Future in Goodreads. And here Sarah was clearly no less preoccupied by the corporatization of daily life, but went on to, she agreed with Lanier's human-centered focus, but disagreed with the way he was simplifying the argument, maybe, or putting the onus of corporate power, or clearly focusing corporate power in one direction, and simplifying it consequently. So Sarah asked us to see it in more complex terms, as power being kind of distributed through thousands of intermediaries. And if anybody's ever worked with software, you realise that that's the case. But that might not be so obvious when you're clicking on an ad, because you think it's all Google, but it's much more to it than that. Reading Sarah's blog, we found somebody who was sceptically optimistic. Sarah's words earlier. I'll say what I think what I mean by that, but anyway, but I know that's Sarah's choice of term. She sees the promise in what data can do, in that it opening up opportunities for optimization and uncovering insights from correlations. But it's consistently argued that for most consumers, it's all hidden in a big data black box. And what's desperately needed here is transparency and dialogue, to put it in short form.
First of all, thank you to Kada, to Jared and Sophia. And just to say that I was amazed that when they called me and they got in touch with me, I actually got an email first, that these reports that I wrote in collaboration with Angela Guimarães Pereira and Paolo Curvelo, you know, you're asked to do this philosophical work or ethical work for the commission, and then you write these reports, and you have a feeling that they end up in the land of nowhere, somewhere in online, and, you know, that you don't really see how it could be useful, because the commission, on one sense, they ask you to do it. In another sense, it's hard to see how they really incorporate what you write or what you think in what they do. So to hear that this report was actually downloaded and somebody was reading it and it was resonating, you know, it was just, wow. So thank you. I mean, yeah. And it's a pleasure to be here. Okay, so I'm going to use the next half an hour or so to share with you some elements of reflection about this thing called the Internet of Things, which is not a very catchy name. How many of you have heard of it or know? Some of you, most of you, yeah. So it's not really hard to say it. It's not really great to, it's not that catchy, but it came out in the late 90s, but it became kind of more popular over the next few years. And it's the idea that the physical world can merge with the world of the internet, essentially. And we're more familiar with the other world, which is smart. We're all familiar with the fact that objects can become instrumented with sensors, intelligence in the strict sense of being able to process information, and interconnected because we all deal with these objects that we all carry around all the time and we call smartphones. So the idea is that everything can become smart around us. Our homes, our cars, infrastructures, electrical grids, sheep and cattle, everything can get sensors and can be interconnected with everything else. So I'm just going to deal with the question today with you, and then it's an open question. So we're going to talk about it later. I'm just going to give you some elements, possibly, of reflection. I'm going to talk about imaginaries, which is essentially, we'll get to that, but it's essentially a way of talking about visions. world visions and some of the implications and consequences and contradictions implied in these visions by which the Internet of Things is portrayed, communicated in the media and online, offline. And some of these contradictions will be helpful to think about the question. So, like I said, it's the ideas that the physical world is get connected and into a symbiosis somehow with the digital world of computing and with the virtual world of the internet. So it's the idea that all physical things start to have a digital set, not only one, but a set of digital counterparts and virtual representation. So we all have that, you know, digital counterparts of my identity is the data that are stored, my music, my books, my friends, if I use social networks, and then they're all virtually represented and I carry them around because they're all stored in remote servers called clouds. It's a magical world, as we will see. So things are instrumented, interconnected, like I said, and intelligent in the way that the strict definition of able to process information and make choices about this information. Intelligence can mean many other things, of course. So in this sense, they are defined as smart. And as you see, when you start to say that objects have identity, personality, and agency, you start to blur subjects and objects. And also when you start to say that we subjects have digital counterparts, we are represented by data, we kind of become objects. So subjectivity and objectivity are kind of merged. And it's useful to think about this merging, to think about the origin, the Germanic origin, the root of the term thing, which is in the name of the Internet of Things. So the root of the world is Ding, and it denotes both the facts, the objects, the objects, the neutral objects of investigations, and also the issues at stake, the matters of concerns, the modes and functions of existence of these entities, of the objects, evoking the realms of values and subjectivity. So it's interesting to see that the root of the word thing actually has inside both objectivity and subjectivity. And many philosophers have been reflecting on this ambiguity and duality. And the latest one is Bruno Latour, sociologist and philosopher, who said, long before designating an object throwing out of the political sphere and standing there objectively and independently, the ding, or thing, has for many centuries meant the issue that brings people together precisely because it divides them. There's something to talk about. You know, the roots of democracy also from ancient Greece come from this kind of idea. So then we talked a little bit about the ontology of the Internet of Things, things as objects. What are the, on the other side of the duality, what are the things that the IoT, I'm just going to say IoT because it's easier, is supposed to address, the values, the issues, and more generally, what kind of world is populated by whom, with what modes of existence is implied by this vision, by the IoT vision? And in exploring these words, we will find out, and it's useful to think about how things can be contradictory in exploring these worlds and how they work. And a contradiction is useful. When you step into a contradiction, it can be useful because it's a way for you to be aware of the limitation of your framework. So a contradiction is usually a set of problems that cannot be resolved within the frame of reference in which they are conceived. So that when you step into a contradiction, you realize that limitation of this framing. So this is what we're going to try to do over the next minutes. And a desirable way, like John mentioned, that all these framings are kind of implicit. Most of these framings are implicit. We kind of go with it. We're encouraged to go with it without even thinking about it. So these contradictions are not really visible or maybe to some of us are more visible than others. Anyway, the idea is that by looking at this contradiction and uncovering some of the assumption of this framework, we can start to have a creative and collective reflection about what the IoT is about and what the innovation in general is about. Because the frame of reference of the IoT, more generally, the IoT is one example of technological innovation. Innovation is a word that we all know. Also, when we need to get funded for something, and we need to deal with institutions, and the word innovation is very prominent. In the European context, which is the one that I got more familiar to recently, the IoT belongs, visions and implementation belong to the digital, so-called digital agenda, which is one of the flagship, the main initiatives of the European strategy for a smart, sustainable and inclusive growth. Here you start to see how innovation is related to smart, being sustainable. Sustainability is another keyword that is everywhere. And inclusive growth, and growth is at the heart of our problem and promises and hopes. And so this is one of the key drivers of the so-called, now it's called the Innovation Union. It used to be called the Knowledge. At some point it became the Union of Knowledge. Now it's in the Innovation Union. So what is innovation? What is the grand story of innovation? I'm just going to take a little bit the story of innovation to go back to the IoT. So the grand story, the main story about innovation, is the idea that our well-being, our welfare, is associated with growth, which means not only growth, linear growth, but indefinitely accelerated consumption growth. Not only has to grow, but it has to grow faster and faster. And this has to mean in consumption growth, and this has to happen within a closed and finite system, which is our planet, that has limited resources, stocks, and limited resilience to, resilience meaning resistance or way to get back to a certain balance when you get to stretch it too much. Example of this, climate change. We kind of messed up with the carbon cycle, biogeochemical cycle, by, you know, putting a lot of CO2 and gases in the atmosphere in a very short time. And this carbon was actually accumulated over geological era in the soil. So it kind of broke the cycle. The resilience of this of the biochemical resilience globally has been disturbed, which is not a problem for the Earth. It just might be a problem for us because we've been evolving into this kind of balance. So we're trying to maintain the stability of our well-being and our, more generally of our life-supporting system in a regime which is getting more and more evidently a regime of resource scarcity, and other ingredient of the whole thing, of the whole problem that we're dealing with in a globally competitive market. One of the main problems of globalization is the fact that market can be saturated overall, and we're all compete with each other. So how do we solve these problems? How do we get out of it? Well, you know, resources can be finite, but human creativity is unlimited. This is the answer that came out of also of Malthus' idea that we were all going to die because we didn't have enough food, because the population would grow too much and too fast, going back in the end of 1700s. And then we did survive the paradox of Malthus because technology helped us to make more food and improve the conditions in which we live. And this is the same answer. Human creativity is unlimited, and human power is unlimited. So the idea that by using creativity and scientific, technological creativity, we are able to decouple growth from scarcity. Essentially, this means that we can go on forever with the same idea of indefinite consumption growth. Through the idea of optimizing the way we use resources, so by being more and more efficient, and eventually substituting all the way, going all the way, substituting natural resources with technologically enhanced artifacts. The other great thing about technological innovation and human creativity applied to this idea is that we can solve the problems that technology creates. So we have to deal with a lot of complex problems, a lot of uncertainties, a lot of risks or failures, but we can always get away with it in a sense because we can find new technologies that solve the problems that came out. So the example, again, going to climate change, is the idea of manipulating the atmosphere with geoengineering grand plan. So we always have a way out, technological way out. So it is the idea of the silver bullet or of a magic weapon. And innovation is supposed to also solve the idea of saturated markets by opening up new pathways, creating new products ever and ever again that we will all need and that we will all buy, get rid of the old ones, so the market would go on and the consumption growth can go on forever by upgrading products and services. Now the IoT and the Internet of Things narrative or story it responds to all of this. We're going to be smart enough to optimize the way we use energy and we produce things and we do logistics. We're going to substitute ultimately with smart, becoming more smart, smarter, we will ultimately substitute ourselves with enhanced versions of ourselves we already have, in a sense, with the tools that we use. And we're going to tame the complexity and uncertainty with analytics, computing, ever-increasing computing analytics, and way to analyze that data and make decisions based on more and more data. And we're going to open new pathways of consumption with new products, ever, ever, forever. So in order for all this to be possible, there's one condition which is very critical, is that us, meaning citizens of developing and developed countries, we all have to buy the story. Buy the story metaphorically, but also literally. We have to buy the products and keep doing what we're supposed to do and be happier eventually. So how is this encouraged? This is this idea of being, of buying, of keeping, I'm using this word in a kind of a provocative way, of course, but to be happy with this story, to go along with the narrative. We have to be part of a grander world description. And this description is made with words, but also is made with images. Images are very powerful to convey stories and world views. So this narrative of innovation is described and represented through images and imaginaries. So every image is relevant not only for what it shows, but also for what it doesn't show. We don't have as much training in learning how to read images and be critical about images and image making and receiving images as we are with language. So we're not as aware of what's going on with images, and we are surrounded, of course, by them. So it's also relevant for what it shows, but also for what it doesn't show, and for how and why it is made, every image that we have. And images, as we all know, mold our identity. We'll make images, we share images. So these imaginaries that I'm going to introduce are sets of visual and verbal metaphors that are created and communicated both in specialized literature, meaning scientific journals as well. We're not going to talk about it now, but part of the research that I did was also to look at scientific journals and how images are used, and mass media and public at large. And we can identify, and we will do that in a moment, four axes, four dimensions of this imaginary, four different imaginaries that create a space for us to navigate into. And actually, we're kind of stuck. We will see we're kind of stuck in that space. And the imaginaries are wonder, power, control, and urgency. And they correspond to the question. Wonder is related to what we want. In the wonder part of the story that is desirable, power and control is related to the idea that we can, that the story is possible. And urgency is related to the idea that that it's needed, that this innovation is not only possible and desirable, but is needed. So with that in mind, we will start with wonder. So now I took a little bit of a trip in a more abstract ideas, going back to more specific things. We're going to analyze a few clips that were made available online a few years ago, and they're all talking about the possibilities of the IoT, of the Internet of Things scenario. One of them came out in 2011, and it was 5 minutes. It's all available on YouTube, and we'll probably, if you're curious to see, we'll give you a link. Or you can just type in the title. It's called A Day Made of Glass by Corning. Corning is a manufacturer based in the U.S., upstate New York, who makes smart glasses, specialty glasses like the one that touch screens are made of, and more sophisticated ways of making touch screens. And the video was about an American family running through the day from day to night, surrounded by these smart glasses. So I'm just gonna, this is the subject, I'm just gonna go back for a moment to the definition of wonder, of this imaginary. And it's the idea that science and technology or techno-scientists can open the gates for us to the unknown. This imaginary is, now we're gonna talk about IoT, we're talking about IoT, but they can be applied to many other emerging technologies like nanotechnology. The stories are very similar. Synthetic biology, biotechnology, all these emerging technologies that go into this innovation idea. So the idea that science and technology can open the doors of the unknown, and technology allow, in this case, effortless interaction with the external environment, be it social, cultural, natural. And the idea is a technological mediated or virtual experience is more valuable or rewarding than a direct one. Yeah, I got a note saying that I forgot, which I knew I was going to forget to say, that of course my opinions do not reflect the opinion of the European Commission. Thank you. This is recorded. A disclaimer is important. So going back to what I was telling you, here we are into this clip. I'm just going to tell you a couple of stories. We're following these families, a mother and a father, two daughters. They wake up, and there's a smart glass going from dark to bright to transparent. The sun comes in, and another glass is on with the alarm, and they have the news, the stock market, and the weather, which is very similar to a setup that we can have here now. And then they walk into the bathroom, and the mother, which we then know to be called Jennifer, starts the morning routine to wash her face, and then the window in front of the sink lights up, and she has a social network, her agenda, everything of the day, calendar of the day, and she gets a message from the office saying, "Oh, your main meeting has been advanced 1 hour. It's now 1 hour before. Can you make it?" And of course, real time, the virtual existence of Jennifer is always connected. The real one is still kind of washing up. She says, "Yes, of course I can make it. No problem." Because, of course, why? Because, smart technology will allow her to get there on time. So she skips the breakfast, she has an apple, runs out, and her car is connected, of course, smart, and there's an accident ahead, but she knows, and so the car knows, so she knows, she takes the right route, and she gets there on time. So, of course, in one sense, they have to sell the glasses. So you say, "Oh, this is just a promotional for the things as objects." The things as objects, remember before, they're just glasses, promotion for products. On the other hand, the worldview, it's also, there's a worldview that is promoted through the video, which is a much more general worldview, pervasive worldview. And it's the idea that you're always on time, that there's no problem, because you have technology will help you to get there. Now, the next step, of course, is that you don't even have to wake up, because your alarm clock is connected to your virtual, to your digital identity and to your virtual representation. So while you sleep, they are awake and they talk to, you know, the virtual representation of your boss or whatever. And so your alarm clock will wake you up exactly at the right time so that you can be exactly at the right time in the office. And it communicates with the coffee maker, warm up the coffee at exactly the right time. The car and the weather condition are taken into account. Everything is great. So essentially, the positive vision, and this, by the way, was a infographic, like a graphic thing coming from another company called Cisco to promote the Internet of Things. So the positive vision is that, again, we live in a world in which we are never late, never lost, never unprepared. See it in another way, the same world is a place in which every minute of our real life is controlled and needs to be controlled by some virtual and digital identities, and it has to be functionally oriented. I cannot have 5 minutes, something wrong goes on, and I have to wait 5 minutes. In those 5 minutes, something else can happen. We all know that, you know, surprises can be good and bad, or can open up new ways of looking at things. So it's a world in which we can't be late, lost, or unprepared. So essentially, our relationship with the unknown is implicitly and ideally eliminated by technology. So this form of eradication of surprise entails abdicating to one of the most fundamental sources of human creativity, as we all know, and learning, which is our capacity to adapt to complexity, learn from the unexpected, and learn how to respond to the unexpected, which goes from the most trivial thing of a traffic jam. Or if you think about GPS and never getting lost again, you see how many people don't know anymore how to navigate without a GPS. It's the most common thing. So we don't know how to ask anymore. It's very weird. We don't know how to look at a map. We don't know how to orient. Maybe most of you know. I get lost with or without, but it's another story. So in general, here's the first contradiction. What makes us safer and more efficient can be also seen as the very same cause of our increased vulnerability to change. So going back to the same video, I mean, it's a second episode, because the first episode was so successful, millions of people saw the clip. Now it's, I think, 25 million people. But, I mean, in the first few months, it was like tons of people connected, so they made another one, a sequel, and now we follow the story, the day of the daughters, as they go to school. I'm just going to focus on one example, and then you can see, they take a day trip to a park, and Sarah, the older one, takes this day trip to a park, and then you get there and you see this wall made of glass that is, of course, is a smart glass. So there's a guide and it shows the properties of the forest. You see all the information coming up, you know, the kids looking at the glass, it's transparent. So first of all, it's information about the forest, and then at some point it's augmented reality with the dinosaur coming out, the 3D thing coming out, and the kids being very happy and scared at the same time, and the guy talking about, you know, dinosaurs, where they come from and everything. So then they come back, the daughter comes back at home at night, and she shares the experience by plugging in the data of the experience into another screen at home with the mother. So you see the same vision of the dinosaurs, and the mother is, everybody's happy, and everything is great. So here we have another aspect of this vision, which is the idea of augmenting our reality. There's a voiceover when the kids are in front of the glass and that says, oh, this is great because the glass is transparent, is informative, is entertaining, and it protects from the forest. So here we are in a paradoxical situation in which we claim that we need to augment, or we augment our reality, being in a forest or family gathering or whatever, by preventing ourselves to physically, mentally, and I would say also spiritually experiencing in the first place. So the question is, what happens when you take out, you go for a mediated experience as opposed to a real experience? And this is not just a promotional video talking about this. We all know that when you go around into touristic places that you know, you relate to, familiar, in Italy there's a lot of those, or here, you see that a lot of people are not really there, the tourists, that they're just taking pictures, taking, you know, selfies. So they're kind of into a thing that they already, they are into a mediated experience. They don't just, they're not really there. Or we are not really there. I'm not taking myself out of this. Okay, now then we go to this other dimension, which has to do with what is possible. So what is possible means that we have a power to control and to extend our limits, the limits of that we have as human beings through the creative manipulation of life, matter, and energy. And these are just very general definitions because they can be used in different examples. So we need this power, we have this power with technology, and then we need to control this power, otherwise we are lost. There was a famous commercial many years ago in the 90s in Italy where it was a commercial of Pirelli, which is a very famous tire company. So the picture, I don't have it here, but it's an athlete, very famous athlete in the 90s called Carl Lewis, a sprinter. So he's about to sprint and he's wearing high heels, red shoes with very high heels on a wet surface. And of course the slogan is, power is nothing without control, which is very, you know, eloquent in the sense that once you have that technological power, if you don't know the side effect, you don't know how to control what comes with it, you're lost. So the idea that we have both, that we can enhance the known and control and treat the unknown. So this is another clip that came out around the same time, maybe a little bit earlier. It's called Welcome to the Decade of Smart. It's by IBM. And it was one of the first, the IBM came out with this campaign in 2008, very, very popular, called Smarter Planet. Let's build a smarter planet. So IBM started to sell services, not only products or machines. And the idea is that that we can all, it was one of the first visions where everything can become smart. And in the video you see, you have three different stills coming from the clip. One is like you see the city, and then you have algorithm and analytics and people. And they're all on the same level. So human beings, data, and infrastructures, they all belong to the same ontology, going back to the beginning. They all are in symbiotic interaction. They are all the same thing. I'm not going into this, but it's very interesting that the same aesthetic that is used here in the 80s, that it's used here in 2008, comes from a very groundbreaking visionary work that was artistic work that was done in the 80s by Godfrey Reggio, into a trilogy, the director called, the first one was called Koyaanisqatsi. I don't know how many of you. Yeah, so it's the title comes from Hopi language. It means life out of balance. So it was kind of a trip. There was no words. You can find it online. There's a three of them. And life out of balance is the technological life. And the idea that technology is all around us, we don't see it anymore. We breathe technology in the director's words. The music is by Philip Glass, many of you know, probably. And the photography is by Ron Ricke, who was a great cinematographer. Anyway, so the same time lapse, people walking very fast, the city life as little ants. And the same aesthetic goes into this, but the message is completely overturned. What is like, you know, it used to be life out of balance, and now is, let's become a smarter planet. So the story that is told in this narrative is this. This is by Sam Palmisano in 2008, right after Barack Obama was elected at the U.S. Office of Foreign Affairs, presenting this new vision of the world. And he says, it's obvious that when you consider the trajectories of development driving the planet today, that we're going to have to run a lot smarter and more efficiently, especially as we seek the next areas of investment to drive economic growth and move large part of global economy out of recession. Remember, 2008 was the year of financial crack. These mundane processes of business, government, and life, again, look at the symbiosis or equivalence, business, government, life, which are ultimately the sources of this crisis. So the cause is, we don't know. The sources of the crisis, the fact that we're slow, we're not smart enough to be sustainable. So the idea is that the planet is a highly complex system. It's kind of, the planet is an infrastructure. It's a machine running at a growing speed. We don't know why. It's kind of a physical phenomenon demanding more energy and resources. So it's taking for granted that it's as it is. Climate, energy, food, and water need to be efficiently managed in order to meet the challenge of a growing population and a global integrated economy. Let's think about the narrative in general that we mentioned before. So we have these sudden and unexpected wake-up calls like the financial crack, and they need to be governed. How? By infusing intelligence into the way in which, literally, into the way the world works, the system, the processes that enable physical goods to be developed, manufactured, bought, and sold, services to be delivered, everything from people to money to oil, water, electrons to move billions of people to work and live. So we go from energy or infrastructure all the way to the way we live our life. So the vision is, the idea is that if the world, our world, is slow, obsolete, congested, socio-technical machine, ruled by just the law of thermodynamics, like a machine, and in not by those of governance or decision-making or will or values. If this is the case, then the promise of innovation or the Internet of Things to optimize its functioning and solving the crisis is objectively needed. The machine needs a new upgrade. So what's happening here? If we think about it, like we saw now, all the values that are implied, forget about the living, what is a living system that is not a machine, but even us and our way of relating with each other and all the values that we share, they're out of the picture. How is that is it possible? Because the matters of concern, they become data. So the normative dimension become a technical dimension. The normative problem become the political problem or governance problem. The way we, what do we want with our life and how do we deal with each other, how do we solve this, becomes a technical issue. We just need more computing power to analyze more data and we will know how to work, what to do. Which is a modern example of a very old idea that equates the truth and the good. So the idea that if you know all the facts, then you rationally do the best, which is a very modern idea that we're not going to get into, but it can be discussed, of course. So not only the things about the decision need to be taken are transformed, but also the we, of course. That we who gather around these things, the matter of concern, is fundamentally transformed and substituted, because if you do that, then the most efficient decision maker is not a human being anymore, is a cyborg or a robot, somebody who can really deal with all this information. If you want to become smart, able to process information, you need to be connected to a machine or become a machine. So our only commitment becomes allowing our machine and the companies, of course, that produce them, to keep optimizing our life. And we think that it's IBM and it's a campaign, a marketing thing. Maybe it's not really. But you see exactly the same narrative, the same story into the European framework. Official documents. This is a clip that was used to promote the IoT by the European Commission. And one of the characters at some point says, it's crazy, we double our energy in the last 50 years, we can't keep this up. We're in a crisis. How do we solve it? If we want to be smart about energy, we should let energy be smart about itself. And then we get to the final part. So this thing is not only great, possible, desirable, but it's also mandatory and urgent if we want to prevent further collapses. Because if the source of the collapse is that we're obsolete and slow and analog, too analog, not enough digital, then we need to, you know, we need to get going and we need to do this change. And here we get to the final dimension, the fourth axis, which is the idea of urgency. We don't have time to talk. We don't have too much time to discuss. We need to act because we are on the verge of a collapse. So forget about too much dialogue or too much discussions about the framing. We need to act. So there's a morally binding necessity to use technoscience coming from these other imaginaries, possible, desirable, everything is under control, to manage the problem that afflict the planet. Same exact narrative can be applied, or imaginary can be applied to the idea of GMOs, genetically modified organism. We need to feed the planet. There's too many people. There's not enough food. We need to be fast. It's a luxury of, you know, rich countries to be talking about how dangerous they are. You know, meanwhile, everybody's dying, starving. We can use them because of climate change. You can do the whole story. You get to the point where you really need to do it right now. There's no discussion. So same goes with this transition to the Internet of Things. And here again, in these words, which I think are very interesting, he says, 2 years later, same person, the CEO of IBM, former CEO, Sam Palmisano, in London at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Again, the mixture, the campaign was not promoted with the normal, in a normal setup. He went to these institutional places to promote not products, but a world vision to be discussed politically. So he's saying we have already the technological power and control to turn our predicament into opportunity. This came out right after Barack Obama election. And remember the slogan was, yes, we can. So here we are. Yes, we can. It's great. Let me leave you with one final observation called from our learning over the past year. This building a smarter planet is realistic precisely because it's so refreshingly not ideological. No problem. There's nothing to be discussed. So here we see that how we get into a box, which is the thing that I was wanted to remember the first question. It's a box of innovation. We want, it's wonderful, we'll have better products, better lives, happier. We can, we have the power, and there's no problem. We can control the power, and we need to do it. So this box within this framing, innovation, technological innovation becomes inevitable. It's outside, it becomes somewhere outside of the democratic arena. So it's a wonderful operation, if you think about it. It works really well. So I'm just going to finish with a few perspectives from different decades in the past. This comes from Eisenhower, when leaving the country, president of the U.S., in the farewell address to the country, he says, the prospects of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocation, the power of money is ever present and gravely to be regarded. So science has to be independent from politics, has to be left alone. Very, very good. Yet, in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. It's very interesting because it's in the 60s. So all this was not in the horizon. Ten years later, Hannah Arendt, German philosopher, in an essay coined Thinking and Moral Consideration, Is our ability to judge, to tell right from wrong, beautiful from ugly, dependent on our faculty of thought? Do the inability to think and disaster of failure of what we commonly call conscience coincide? The very word conscience, at any rate, points in the direction insofar as it means to know with and by myself, which means that I have enough time, enough solitude, I'm not connected all the time, and I have enough time to have my own thoughts and dealing with them and making mistakes and learning from them and move on. A kind of knowledge that is actualized in every thinking process. It comes from a very, you know, one of the most famous work is The Banality of Evil. So it's very much related to this idea that once you are not able to think, you end up in this banality of evil. You don't feel responsible anymore. Not that you're not responsible, you don't feel responsible anymore. And this brings me to the next decade with this, comes from the art world actually. Volker Arlan and Joseph Beuys, very famous German artist. Volker Arlan was his friend, artist, intellectual. There's this very, very nice book. There is a conversation between the two in the 80s. It's called, the title is What is Art? So he's saying, for several years I've been working with a formulation of the aesthetic that goes back to the origins as the opposite of anesthetic, of numbness. From this perspective, aesthetic comes to mean enlivened being. Think about the wonderland and the difference. This not only turns the contemporary uses of aesthetic as something rather cosmetic and superficial on its head, but it links such enlivened being to responsibility. Not as a moral imperative, but as a responsibility, or the ability to respond. So what do we lose when we lose our ability to respond to what's around us? So I'm just going to finish with the first question. And, you know, as I said, it's an open question. With all that said, do we really want and need to be smart? Can we? And the related questions are, what do we want to sustain? What world do we want to sustain, and for whom? You know, for whom is all this? What is this about? How is this applied to whom? And then, of course, do we want to function or to live or to be alive? Do we want to survive by just functioning, or do we want to be alive? And that I leave this as a, you know, open question for dialogue. Thank you. I don't know the time.
So I'm so glad you were talking about Sam Palmisano, because in 2008, I was working as an analyst for a piece of Gartner, which is a kind of technology analyst firm that looks at what IBM and Microsoft are doing and tries to make sense for the CIOs and CTOs of Fortune 500 companies, whether or not they should buy Microsoft SharePoint or the next thing from IBM. And so I was in the midst of looking at smart rhetoric, I suppose. And basically my job was to cut through the marketing rhetoric and talk more about, like, what does this really mean? Is this just a new way to sell software? So that actually is what leads me to this talk today, and also in general the work that I have evolved to do as a technology critic. So let me just flip this so I can have my notes.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah. Whoops. This one. So this is actually, I'm going to be also talking a lot about metaphors and kind of conceptual framing. So our two talks really are in dialogue with each other very much. And so this is actually based on a piece that I wrote for Dis Magazine, which is kind of a arts New York culture critical work. And this was in the piece about big data. And so in it, I'm specifically looking at the metaphors that we use to talk about data, because I think a lot of those metaphors are coming directly from industry, marketing, language, without getting processed into something that's more culturally relevant and contextualized in a way. And so some of this is also based in my work looking at how those terminologies and framings actually move from the technology industry into the way journalists write about them, and then as they kind of infiltrate into the popular consciousness. So very much along those lines. So, and in part, looking at these metaphors, I am looking at what the alternatives might be. So not only just unpacking what the kind of technocratic position is in putting forward a certain type of metaphor, but trying to think through what the alternative metaphors are and what power they have and how they can be deployed to reinsert as an individual position on things. And so some of this is also based on my work at the Oxford Internet Institute. So I am a very interdisciplinary person and have found my way into the work that I'm doing right now from this starting point, from working at Gartner, but also being really interested in the kind of ethnographic side of how technology influences people. So when I was at the Oxford Internet Institute a few years ago, I was working on kind of an ethnography of people in the quantified self community who are using apps and sensors to create data about themselves. And so I was very interested in their approach to thinking about their relationship to data, in part because they were almost empowered and asking for something more than what most people were starting to ask for in terms of their own interest in their personal data. And so in doing that research, I was very much interested in the way that they were thinking about their relationship, and that's kind of where some of this metaphor work comes out. But I've also been an English major as an undergrad, so metaphors have always been kind of in the back of my mind as something important to understand and unpack and to think about the rhetorical work that they do in framing. So when we do a search for the word data, this kind of visceral image collection comes up, which is, or rather not visceral. So it's kind of ones and zeros, this cool electric blue, but it doesn't actually tell us anything about what the nature of data is. It's just this kind of reiterating blueness that suggests the computer. So we instead have, because we have so few ways of visualizing the metaphor of what data is and what it looks like, we resort to language to come up with physical metaphors to make bits and data understandable and tangible and legible. But then we end up with these absurd metaphors like data is the new bacon. And so this is actually coming from one of those tech companies. This is a t-shirt for Cloudera, which is a Hadoop and Apache big data services company. So here, I don't know if this really crosses contextual boundaries, but I think in the United States, bacon is the new trendy thing. So I think that's what they're kind of getting at with this, data is so trendy that it is the next new thing, or it's an iteration on data is the new black as a concept. And you see this in headlines saying, like, the data scientists are the sexiest job of the 21st century. Like, what does it mean to be a sexy job, first of all? But also, it kind of gets reiterated and pushed out into the public imagination of what is new and different and important. So we see these kinds of newness metaphors suggesting, you see, data is the new oil, data is the new currency, data is the new black, data is the new bacon. So this kind of class of metaphors for talking about data is really suggesting that data is trendy and new. So when I see those kinds of industrial metaphors trying to push something forward, I was inspired to look at the work of Lakoff and Johnson in this great book, Metaphors We Live By. So they are very much interested in looking at the way metaphors are a means of taking something that's abstract, like data or a complex idea, and trying to put it into something that we understand because we have a frame of reference. So they're not only interested in the linguistic tools of metaphors, but also their conceptual power for kind of shaping the way we think and frame the world around us. So back to your point about framing. So a couple examples just to go through from their work is as a way of understanding just how embedded metaphors can be. The idea that argument is war. You have things like people saying, your claims are indefensible, he attacked every weak point in my argument, his criticisms were right on target. All these words just come straight from a war context, and that directly influences what is possible in the context of an argument. So Lakoff and Johnson write, many of the things we do in arguing are particularly structured by this concept of war. It is in the sense that argument is war metaphor is one that we live by in this culture. It structures the actions we perform in arguing. So it becomes so foundational and fundamental that we almost don't know that it's there or don't notice that it's there. And the same is true of time is money. So you think of the idea of, you're wasting my time, this gadget will save you hours, I don't have the time to give you, how do you spend your time these days? All of these things are suggesting a kind of valuative relationship of time. And so time is money is one of these metaphors that is just so foundational that it is, you don't even notice that you're using it as a metaphor. And I think that's what's really important in Lakoff and Johnson's work is to say just how embedded metaphors can be once they are the frame of reference. And I think that's in particular important when we're talking about new technologies as well, because we're in the moment where we get to decide what the frame of reference is. So I'm also looking at kind of the physical metaphors of how we introduce new technologies historically as a way of trying to relate to prior technologies or prior experiences. So this example of the television in the living room, the cathode ray tube is actually framed by the domesticating kind of furniture element. So initially, televisions were not just boxes, they were things designed to look like furniture to fit into the rest of the context of your house. And similarly, when early cinema started taking off, the initial screens would have the proscenium arch echoing the proscenium arch of the theater so that you had a reference point to understand what you were about to see, that it was a performance in the context of the theater. And oftentimes in the same space of the theater, so you would have a double proscenium arch once in the actual theater itself and the representation of that on the screen. And we also rely on these metaphors when we're talking about our digital interfaces. So designers tend to call these skeuomorphs, which is a very clunky term for visual metaphor. We have in the old case of, I think this was Apple, iOS at some point, the legal pad and the tape recorder and the like felt gaming table, the green felt of a pool table, trying to use these visuals to teach you how to use the thing. But then they also fall away when we start to actually understand how they're supposed to be used, and we've kind of flattened everything because we no longer have to, we've become familiar with the desired interaction that designers had for us. So just as metaphors can reveal these truths by association, metaphors can just as easily obscure and misrepresent, especially when they're happening under the radar. And Lakoff and Johnson importantly suggest that metaphors can prime us to take for granted the ways that we think about things. So this is kind of where I'm very interested in looking at metaphors and where they're coming from and what their kind of power might be in being applied and accepted. So Lakoff and Johnson say the people who get to impose their metaphors on the culture get to define what we consider to be true. So if all of the metaphors that we have to understand data at this point are coming from one source or one kind of positionality, that is certainly giving those metaphors a lot of power. And I would argue that some of them, as suggested earlier, are coming directly from places like IBM, places like Gartner, where they're talking about the hype cycle of the next set of technologies. You may have seen that absurd, what is it, the trough of disillusionment. I never worked on any of those, but these are the places where the language originates and where it comes from and kind of pushes forward into the popular consciousness. But it even comes from places like The Economist with, you know, whatever their visualization of data is the new oil dripping on the front page of, or the cover page of The Economist. So I think what's important here for me is to unpack just how much of an industry-centric bias there is in these ways of talking about data. So now I want to go through some really concrete examples of where these metaphors are coming from and what they're trying to say about data. So we hear things like, we are learning to cope with the data deluge and we're working out how to best tap into it. So these kinds of framings suggest that data is liquid or it is a natural resource. So they're trying to talk through the kind of fluid nature of where this data flows and where it's coming from and where it's going. But we're also talking about it at an overwhelming scale. So it's something to be thought of as in disaster terms or something that can't be controlled. It's so overwhelming, it's a volume of data. And that kind of perpetuates the idea that we're getting into something that's so big. Data is a byproduct, so we see the framing of talking about data as an exhaust, which I think is very interesting, but it's suggesting that the byproduct is a result of the transactional traces of digital interactions, but it's also suggesting that it is wasteful and pollutive and may not be meaningful without any kind of processing. So this idea of an exhaust suggests that there's a trail of digital output from all of our interactions that is pollutive and messy and gross. And then you get similar terms when people talk about being a data janitor, like cleaning up the data. It's a messy process. data wrangler, I suppose, kind of fits into both of these two categories. And then we have data is the new oil. So this comes from Cisco, but this one, this framing has been often repeated. This is the idea that data is an industrial process. And so this, of course, pushes on the positionality of the companies who are doing the selling of products that help create this industry. But it also suggests that there's a certain natural resource involved here with data, that it is something to be mined and refined and brought out of the ground, but it must be handled by experts and large-scale systems to make it meaningful and usable. There are other similar natural resource metaphors. Data is oil. Data is being talked about as a gold rush. We also talk about it as an ecosystem, or something to be kind of gathered. We're gathering data as if it's like out there in the natural world, and we're collecting it like mushrooms or something. One person I spoke to, so the data is the new oil has a lot of baggage, of course. Oil is problematic in a lot of ways. So somebody, an advertising executive, suggested that he wanted to reframe it as data is the steel of the digital economy. And so he suggested that that kind of gets away from the negative oil connotations, fossil fuels, whatever, but still addressing the idea that there might be a monopoly involved. So he was in a small advertising firm, and he was very much interested in describing the monopoly power of Google and Facebook in the kind of traditional steel industry, you know, robber baron era association. So all of those metaphors, as kind of catch-all ways of framing, are still all from the position of the company or the technological power. They have nothing to do with the people that the data refers to. Instead, they're taking the power away from the person and placing it with those who have the tools to analyze and interpret data. Data becomes obscured, specialized, and distanced from actual people. So these metaphors might make sense for selling technology products, but they don't actually give us a sense of what it means to live in a data-driven society. So Jer Thorpe is somebody who has tried to salvage this connection between the oil metaphor and the kind of physical reality, and he suggests that the way to draw a line to the more personal side of things is to suggest that, he says, where oil is composed of the compressed bodies of long-dead microorganisms, this personal data is made from the compressed fragments of our personal lives. It is a dense condensate of our human experience. So he's trying to tie it back to the fact that there are kind of carbon cycles going on with, you know, fossils, literally bodies involved in the processing of this new economy. So I think the issue that I take with all of these industrial metaphors is that in Lakoff and Johnson's context, those metaphors are missing the basic domain of experience, which is that of the body, that of the interaction with our physical environment, that which we can understand because we live in bodies and understand the world around us through those bodies. Instead, they're kind of in the bodiless conglomerate of, you know, Google. So Lakoff and Johnson suggest that some of the most effective metaphors, or the ones that are just so foundational that we forget their metaphors, are based on this embodied cognition, this idea that I understand the world through my physical instantiation. Whoops. How do I scroll? one of the examples that they gave of this is the idea that things can be so foundationally based on your body being upright as a sign of being living, that the idea of good is up is so fundamental to life itself, that your directionality going down is bad, being depressed is bad, the stock market going down is bad, because it has to do with death as opposed to being upright. So one of the really interesting metaphors that makes this kind of cognitive jump between the body and the mind is the word fathom. So fathom is the measurement of the depth of the ocean, but it is coming literally from the measure between, you know, the end middle finger of a sailor, the amount of rope that he could pull out. So I think it's something like 6 feet or 1.8 meters. So this is completely based on a human scale as a form of measurement. But where it makes the metaphorical jump to suggest that a concept is something that you can fathom, so I couldn't fathom the idea of something, is the idea that you have to be able to get your arms around the idea, that it is something that can be abstract and conceptual is still something that can be physically grasped by a body. And I like this metaphor as a way of jumping into what embodied metaphors might look like for data in a way to explain them, because it is very much both about the physical measurement of bodies, which comes up in the quantified self community, of course, but also because it is grappling with this intangibility of something by making it tangible and physical. So my argument here is that I think the way to resolve some of this excessive focus on the industrial process is to look to other more personalized metaphors. And I think what's important about doing that is that they can then inform a larger public discourse about how we talk about data, and ideally, you know, shape policy and shape new technologies and potentially even business models going forward if users and individuals can demand certain things of companies in different ways with using different language. So some of the metaphors that I was uncovering talking to the quantified self community have all addressed this kind of embodied sense. So one of them is thinking about data as a shadow. So it still has this exhaust type relationship to the body. It is not clear that you only have an outline of the body, but it is at least attached to the body and has some kind of identifying nature to it. These metaphors acknowledge the presence of a person, but point to the kind of disjuncture with the fact that their person is not actually there. And it's also interesting because you don't really have any control over what your shadow looks like. And so that kind of is useful in the context of where our data representation kind of trails behind us in a way. One of the metaphors I really enjoyed, especially in the quantified self community, is the idea of data as a self-portrait. So there's this kind of agency involved in choosing how to represent yourself, what things you decide to track. Obviously, this is not a data portrait, but the idea that data is something that you can use to understand yourself and also present yourself to other entities. But I like the fact that it's somewhat artistic and interpretive and creative sense of constructing a sense of self with data. But of course, that may mean that the self-portrait is granular and maybe bitty or not yet photorealistic or photorealistic in a strange way, like this Chuck Close painting. Another one is data as a practice. So this is somewhat about the embodied experience. So the quantified self community in the popular press in the like 2010 range were often talked about as being narcissistic and navel gazing because, you know, who cares about looking at your own personal data all the time? It must be a narcissistic tendency to want to look at that all the time. But I'm trying to get back at the kind of original sense of navel gazing, which is that of introspection. So meditation is often described as a process of looking inward and literally looking at your navel as a means for looking inward and as a practice towards self-knowledge. So a lot of the way that the quantified self community talk about data is as a both as a tool and also as a means of reflection by creating a practice around that. Data is a mirror. So I chose this specific example of a mirror in part because data is something that can be reflected on, but of course, also in this case, you have a third-party painting the perspective. So there's some element that actually suggests that there's a larger system in play. You are limited to what you can see in the mirror, even though it's supposed to be kind of as direct a reflection of who you are as you can get. And I also like it because mirror is arguably one of the first technologies for understanding ourselves as others see us. But again, it can be a distorted view, it can be a dysmorphic position if the mirror is a certain format. So the idea behind all this is to try to start pushing towards these more physically oriented metaphors. What can they tell us about what it is to live in a data body? And I'm also curious to push some of these metaphors further. So can we suggest that data is like blood or like DNA? We already think about DNA as kind of having a biological information programming element, which is, of course, problematic in some ways, but I think it's an interesting exercise to talk through. And so when I first published this article, James Geary, who has also worked on metaphors in the kind of cognitive psychology and kind of neurobio work on the way metaphors play, he suggested that maybe something that might push this kind of system view, but also individual view, and the cyclical view of things as the data as a respiration. And so it's coming in and going out, and that suggests that there's this larger ecosystem, but it's also kind of the nuts and bolts behind all life, basically. And I think that the argument there is that once we turn everything to digital, then that's basically what you end up with. But of course, that comes with problems too if you speed up the carbon cycle beyond the Earth's capacity. So some of the other ones that, have come about try to address not only the individual's position, but also the kind of bigger picture. Others that have gotten thrown out are things like the water cycle or talking about decomposition or I'm interested in kind of expanding the systems view metaphor that would allow the individual to exist in the larger system as well. So why keep talking about all these metaphors? I think these are important because they are shaping the way that we think about the future. So Sally Wyatt has written about the metaphors that we use to talk about the internet as physical spaces. And she suggests in her article about information superhighway and all these kinds of physical instantiations of the internet. She says, metaphors not only help us to think about the future, they are a resource deployed by a variety of actors to shape the future. Metaphors can mediate between structure and agency, but it's actors who choose to repeat old metaphors and introduce new ones. Thus, it is important to continue to monitor the metaphors at work to understand exactly what work it is that they are doing. And I think that is what really motivates all of this work and probably some of yours as well. So I guess my bigger picture questions are, if they're going to shape the way we think about data, there's a certain level of our value systems being embedded in these things. So what kinds of values do they capture and what do they reify? And importantly, who gets to define what those metaphors are? And I just wanted to make a note that, you know, here I've been talking a lot about the data, which is this singular noun. It's the object on which all of this information processing happens. And I think part of that belies the fact that, like, data was the thing that the industry was talking about. So it's important to suggest, okay, maybe that's not the thing we even need to be focusing on. Is it that we need to be thinking through metaphors for talking about the processing or the interpretation or some other piece of it that perhaps has more bearing on our ability to act in the world or limits our possibilities or anything along those lines? So... And when I talked about this with some folks at Data and Society, they were saying, you know, somebody brought up like, oh, you're just only talking about the data, that's the object. And I said, oh yeah, well, what if we talked about the metaphors for algorithms, which could be a whole set of things as on its own. And even the word algorithm is kind of turning a process into a noun. It's kind of objectifying the action or the verb. So I would suggest that maybe we need to think about the kind of action in looking at our future data ecosystem. And so I think another big piece of this is just to think through where the metaphors are employed and to what ends. So is it the companies that are pushing these? Is it the designers who are building them into the interface so that you understand how to use them? Can it be the way that we kind of rise up around a metaphor that is kind of more personally oriented? I think there's some work to be done further to suggest where metaphors can be employed and to what end. So I come from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and that's full of a lot of policy people. So I can't help but think about the influence of the law as being fundamentally a metaphorical process, right? You compare the new thing to something that came before it. Is it like property or is it like... privacy or something like that. So it's important to get to think carefully about exactly which metaphor we're employing and to what ends. And I think the bigger picture in all this is that you know, I was introduced as a technology critic, and I think what I mean by that is to suggest that we are often taking for granted some of the framing and in the introduction of these new technologies into our lives. And so what I'm most interested in doing as a constructive technology critic, because I'm not necessarily suggesting that all of this is bad and we shouldn't be doing this, but that we need to give people a way of talking through this and thinking through it and deciding for themselves what it is that is appropriate or not, or what we're comfortable with or not. And a lot of that has to do with pushing the public discourse in a constructive and dialogical way. If we just only talk about it in the terms that we're given, we can't really get anywhere with pushing the conversation in a different direction.
My name is Diogo. I have a question to Alice. And yeah, first of all, I thought your presentation was really clear and smart. It was very smart, yeah. And I was just wondering, because I missed a reference in your presentation. There's not everybody is in the bubble of the internet. So there is less than half of the population is living with internet. So it's living the internet of things. Yeah. So I want to hear your thoughts about it, especially because I see this talk of innovation is also a way of excluding a big amount of people of humanity. And also because recently I've been getting through the thought that even technology is the fabric, I mean, the production of technology, it's done by raw materials that actually still are slow and still have human labor in a big amount of population that don't live that innovation. So
the shadow, going back to a metaphor, this is the shadow of innovation, the material aspect of all of this. Yeah, thing that refers to one of the last questions, which is what do we want to sustain and for whom? The for whom is very relevant, and this narrative that I've been telling and talking about is very self-referential in a sense. Well, we're all telling this to ourselves, so who's the we? Usually the we is, you know, affluent, people coming from affluent economies or developing economies, people who have access to data, to information, to technological tools, and they should be wanting more. So this is the idea. So the shadow of all of this is everything else, which is, you know, most of, you know, a lot of people in different places. And the idea is that they're slow. They, you know, this is the narrative of progress before innovation. The term before innovation is progress or development. So there is the developed people and the underdeveloped originally. So, yeah, totally. All these talks about the people who has the power, even the sustainability narrative, we have to sustain, we have to be sustainable. Yeah, we have to be, who's the we and who's sustaining what and who and where is all the power issues. In all these talks, usually sustainability, innovation, technological development, all the power relationships are always in the background. You know, even in sustainability conferences, and you know, we talk about climate change, these abstract notions, and you know, the cause of climate change is, you know, deforestation or fossil fuels being, you know, pushed up in the atmosphere. It's very much, the world is very much talked about as a machine. These problems are very much talked about as there's no responsibility in very abstract sense. And this narrative doesn't come only from the industry, it comes from institutions, it comes from governments, it comes from, you know, places like, for example, European Commission or you know, people who usually have the power. It's very hard that they let it go, usually without somebody to say something about it. So,
yeah, and I was just only wondering as well, considering that amount of people that still don't have internet today, they will have it in some years, because the scale of propagating...
Well, this is the assumption that we should all go towards and the future.
My question was, and then perhaps for you both, would be, because we look critical about the Internet of Things. I mean, we all look critical. And did we learn something? So this rest of the population, I mean, how can we change of introducing the internet in this, let's say, in the population that has no internet? How could we introduce it in a better way? Or what was the mistake?
And, don't do it the way that Facebook is doing it. I mean, look at internet.org and Free Basics, and they're, on the one hand, saying that they're going to connect the next whatever billion people, but they're going to connect them the way that Facebook wants to connect them, which is, you know, yeah, controlling the access point. And so, you know, when we talk about like the rhetoric of what the internet is, does that mean access to everything and to the whole system and the wider, the entire network without boundaries? Or do we mean Facebook's mediated internet? And I think that specifically gets at the question of who gets to be on the internet and what that internet looks like for them. The idea that there's one internet versus many internets is something that I think is really important to look at.
Yeah, maybe there's also something else about technology in general, which is an interesting element. It's called a technological lock-in. Once you introduce something, it's part of the interesting times that we're living in. Part of the thing that we're dealing with is the irreversibility of all these things. Once you introduce, because we're basically experimenting on a large scale, not in a laboratory anymore, we're experimenting on our planet, on our life, on our social system, political system. So we introduce a tool globally, we tested a little bit, and then we let it go. And then what happens is an emergent phenomenon that reflects the power system. You know, technology is neutral by itself. It reflects the way it's implemented. It's reflecting the structure, the power structure, if you want to look at it this way, or the social structure, or the political structure in more neutral, or the scientific structure in more neutral terms.
I really like Lakoff's studies about the way metaphors shape our lives. And they also shape the way we comprehend reality. Essentially, that's what they do. And in a sense, I wonder to what point these talks, I like them, and I appreciate your point of view, and it's a shared concern. What are we doing with data, and where do we want our lives to go? But also, I wonder how much of this is informed by a certain tendency that we have to be scared of change, to be afraid of experimenting with our lives, and also a certain prevalence on the idea of scarcity. So all of our society has been built, all of it, on the expectation of scarcity, maybe because we live in the Northern Hemisphere and there's winter. But we eat more than we have to because we expect to be hungry in a couple of hours, and I don't know if I will have food, so let me eat a little bit more. And we need to have more money because we need to save money because there will be a time when I will be unemployed. And that, so this scarcity idea informs the way we behave. And all these talks seem to... It's as if it matters. Oxygen is the largest pollutant on Earth ever. It changed life on Earth permanently. We like it. We would not be here without oxygen. But it killed, like, a lot of life, because there was life before oxygen. There were plants. And then they started doing photosynthesis and boom, oxygen. And oxygen is really, really dangerous. Oxidative stress is supposed to be the major cause of aging and all sorts of diseases. So oxygen is actually highly dangerous pollutant, but it also caused life as it is. So the world is changing. And at what level can we just trust that there is some sort of larger purpose to all of this and just accept that, you know, things change and that some of us die, some of us survive, societies evolve. And why is this, you know, it just bothers me. It's a thought, let's call it.
I think my position on this is I very much am not interested in being anti-progress or anti-technology at all. And I think what I find challenging and what the discourse is, what is difficult in these kinds of questions is the idea that by questioning, you are already against it. And I think I want to be clear about the fact that we have to just be able to talk about it without suggesting that it shouldn't happen. And I think there's one, I think it has to do with the like problems with media reducing everything down to a yes or no question or a binary question, which is in part why I'm doing the work at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, because I think specifically with technology questions, leaving room for more subtlety and more of the yes and or yes but kind of framing is really important.
I'm also not against technology in general, not at all, or science or the progress or whatever wonderful things that we achieved. But we should be, again, following what you just said, we should be able to go out beyond yes or no or scarcity abundance and go, you know, for a more open vision. And the first step is to see what kind of vision we are, the mainstream or whatever we want to call it, or this embedded culture that we are all in. So to have some elements to, you know, be more aware of what's going on. And about scarcity, you know, you talk about it as a metaphor, and, you know, I don't want to argue about that. It's very interesting. But there are physical, you know, he introduced me with all these BA, MFA, MA, whatever. I have a very mixed background, and my original background is physics, so scientific background, theoretical. So scarcity, and you mentioned oxygen, you might be a scientist as well. So there is a point to be said about the fact that we're on a finite, you know. So yes, we can recycle, we can think about inventing new materials, creativity and everything, but there is a point that we should acknowledge that there is possible scarcity at some point behind the corner or in some. So it's a physical also, yeah, change. Kind of, yeah, you're an optimist, kind of like technology will, that's, you know, that's exactly the type of argument that we should have in a democracy.
The question is do you feel the concentration on human metaphors for data is masking the reality that we're like, I don't know what it is, we're like 1 in 10 in terms of the machines making the data? And that's like, I mean, hopefully that kind of ties in with what you're saying. This is the reality that we've had since 2008. And why play around with human metaphors if that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have done a lot of interesting work trying to personify the system, the technological system, or, I mean, even just the fact that we're talking about machine learning as learning in a human context, even though it is nothing like the way humans learn, really in practice, or we can't possibly even begin to understand how they might be learning. Like, once we start getting down that road, part of it is we're humans, like, this is what we've got to understand the world around us. I think in the context, it goes back to the question of to what ends, right? So I think in the context of trying to have a more informed public with the language to talk about these questions in a more robust way, I think that's my personal goal. So using something human.
All I was trying to say was that maybe it could be more inclusive, and I understand the robustness, but maybe saying, if insisting on human metaphors is actually weakening.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for playing with as many possible useful metaphors as we can. I think people still have a hard time trying to think about relationships with things in the kind of Bruno Latour sense of like thingness. So I think it's only a question of the limitation of its application.
Hello, my name is Ricardo. I have a question for both. When you talk in your presentations, you talked a lot about the metaphors or images, with images are metaphors, metaphors are images. You talked about power, control, which is very important because most of the images are about management and efficiency. When you talk, if you use the image or the metaphor of data as power, data as control, data as surveillance, what kind of actions, dialogues, or experiences do you have when you talked about that?
I'm not sure I really get to your point. What I was trying to say is that these metaphors that are imaginaries, the power and control, or the wonder, and they're ways of looking at the at technologies that go beyond the problems of the typical risks. There's a way of talking about new technologies and debating about new technologies, focusing on risks. You know, for example, GMOs, they're going to be dangerous, unhealthy, whatever. The data or the Internet of Things risks are identified with the problem of surveillance or privacy, security of data, which are all very important, and they are discussed in these big institutions. What I was trying to say is let's do a thought experiment. Let's think about a world in which these issues are solved, or they don't matter for now. You know, let's say that privacy is fine, that surveillance, you know, that the security of data is fine. If we think about that everything is going well, what kind of world are we living in? And we can see that even in that case, in that thought experiment, we uncover some interesting places to think about the framework, like contradictions or paradoxes or ways of... So I think I didn't mention these issues, the issue of privacy or security or the sort of control, who's controlling the data. So I didn't use control in that sense, because I was trying to get out of that. Because the tricky part of the talking about risk is that with this complexity and the uncertainty of all these technologies relating with systems, they're so big. The complexity of the problems, it's so big and it's growing. The more you know, the more there is to know. So there will never be a case in which this complexity, uncertainty is such that you know what's going to happen. So most of the talk is about risk, ends up being about delaying decision-making things. Oh, we don't know, the GMOs, we don't have proof that they're dangerous, or climate change is still somehow debatable or debated, you know, is it going to be 1 degree, 2 degrees, 5 degrees? Meanwhile, we just keep doing what we're doing. So another way is to say, what happens if everything goes well? What kind of world do we want to live in? And open up a debate between, you know, people who say, I like this world, I like the way it's going, and the change, the direction is, it's not about changing or not changing, but the change is a given. But what direction, what trajectory are we changing?
I specifically avoid talking about surveillance and privacy just because that has been the dominant opposition to talking about it's the only way we seem to be able to talk about the human individual side of the equation. And I think that's tends towards a sensationalizing, as you say, risk-oriented sense of it. Obviously, those are very important topics, but I think then you bleed into this either-or binary position, which is like either we have the convenience or we're spied on by the NSA and everyone else, and you can't, you're either in the digital world or you're not. And I think those binary oppositions aren't really doing anyone any favors because we are living with it. So
the quantified self community use data as self-improvement or a way to see us in other lenses. Isn't the problem of surveillance fundamental? Because if people are watching us, so who watches the watchman and what watchman? So
sure, or what does even self-surveillance, like what kind of power and discipline, you know, dropping a Foucault bomb there, like that's certainly part of the conversation. Whether or not it's the fear is of an external entity or the own self-regulation in creating data about yourself and becoming a slave to the app that helps you track whatever, or you only think in steps now because you've been wearing a Fitbit for however many days and only understand distance by the number of steps you've taken. So I think there's value in addressing all sides of it, but I think if we only focus on the kind of surveillance side of it, that it's ends up towards sensationalizing territory, which then means we're talking about like anti-progress and like we can't have these things because they're not going to be good for us.
Thank you very much for both interesting talks. I still wonder why the European Union was not presented when you started to talk, but you actually said you're not working for the European Union anymore.
No, I just worked
okay,
on
I'm sorry.
Assignment.
I thought you were working, but you were not.
No. I just
disclaimer.
And I
okay.
extra cautiously okay. disclaim, but I don't. And probably it okay. was not even necessary. So I don't know. I don't
okay.
work for this.
What I think is interesting is like how do we produce public space by coming up with critique, or how do we actually do this talk? And I think it's interesting that we start by language. We start by metaphor critique. We try to find new metaphors. We acknowledge lack of, and there are other people like Bloomberg in the 60s that creating metaphors can be foundational for thinking. They can be distractive in the sense of they're just extras that we can take away or we should criticize, etc. They can mislead totally. On the other hand, also the question is the rhetorics that is behind smartness and what kind of ideas we actually need. And actually, I was waiting a little bit for what. Because I think smartness seems like a bit like everybody wants to be smart. There's kind of a commonsensical, not very extrapolated idea about smartness. But then there's a lot about artificial intelligence, hyperintelligence, superintelligence. There's a lot about enhancing cognitive capacities for the elder, for children, for everybody itself, so there's a big debate going on. And the question is, like, how can we put this together? Because in your talk, I thought a bit, even though I like a lot phenomenological positions, and also I think Hannah Arendt, in a certain way, comes from that idea of an experience of the self that can be embodied, etc., and there's a kind of an extra. But when I think about technology, I always think about doublings of ourselves. I'm not thinking about the Gegenstand in the sense of an object that is absolutely confronting myself with a limit or something, but actually I what I'm more worried with in my work on philosophy of technology is exactly the doublings we're doing, and if these doublings are exactly what we want, or if we have to be protected from what we want. That's a bit.
I mean, I am glad you bring that up, because I think one of the things that I've been interested in is the kind of uncanniness of the experience of being confronted with your data self, your data doppelganger, which is a whole other topic that I could go on for a long time. But the idea that how often do you even get to encounter that doubling, in what context, and what language and what tools do we even have to interpret what that interaction is. So the example that I that kind of sparked this conversation was specifically a targeted ad, but it was a targeted ad for an anorexia study, like a medical university study. And I received this ad on Facebook's, you know, sidebar. And it's like, well, how targeted is this? Like, how am I supposed to interpret this one ad that I know is ostensibly based on a certain amount of data, my data, which I have a sense of what it might be, but to what extent is this particular thing targeted to me based on five data points or my entire browsing history, right? And how should I be offended or should I be worried or should I be like, what is this uncanny interaction? If this is supposed to be me, what am I supposed to think about that? And I think that has a very practical kind of design question that comes out of that, which is, how am I supposed to interpret any of this in this interaction when everything is ostensibly based on data, but for practical purposes is not nearly as sophisticated, especially in the context of a Facebook ad. It's not, you know, whoever's buying that ad is probably just using a certain number of factors like location, age, and sex, and that's it, right? So I think what's missing in a lot of our interfaces are those signals that, you know, in those visual skeuomorphism discussion is like, how targeted is this? What is, you know, what does this say about me? Do I feel comfortable with what went into this? Can I have any input over what is or is not taken into account when I experience this? And I think there's just no ability to control the double right now. And we won't have that control until we start kind of asking for it or thinking about what that control might look like or what that interaction might be.
Thank you.